I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. The time is currently 1:34 p.m. on Wednesday, March 3rd, 2021. Present today, we've got Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter, Representative Lebon, Representative Edgeman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick, Representative, Representative Rasmussen is online, and Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Just a reminder, folks could mute their cell phones. Today we'll get a presentation on the order of operations from the Department of Revenue, and that's with Chief Economist Dan Stickle. It's also joined by Colleen Glover, the Director of the Tax Division. And this presentation is not meant to spur a oil policy tax debate. we just want to help folks to understand how our revenue is generated with respect to calculations of oil taxes. So hopefully we can keep it to that. And with that, Mr. Stickle, if you could unmute yourself, and looks like your video is not up, if it's possible to switch that into video mode. Thank you very much. And if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Awesome, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Stickle. I'm Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. As you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, if there's any difficult questions, I also have our tax director, Colleen Glover, online, and I believe our deputy commissioner, Mike Barnhill, either is online or will be joining us if there's any policy-related questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. And in looking through your PowerPoint, it looks like it is fairly complex, so maybe we'll go ahead and take questions as we go. But if folks could keep in mind our time until 3:30 here in the finance room, we might be able to go a little over, but I know that we do have subcommittees and other commitments, so I'll try to keep things on track and not let us get too far down too many rabbit holes, but I do understand this looks like some fairly complex information, so we'll go ahead and take questions as we go. So with that, thank you very much, Mr. Stickle. If you could go and continue or proceed.
Awesome. And I will try to briefly pause at the end of each slide to see if there are any questions there. So thank you for the opportunity to come present our order of operations presentation about Alaska's oil and gas production tax. The purpose of the presentation is to present a high-level overview of how Alaska's oil and gas production tax works for the North Slope. The discussion is probably a refresher for several of you on the committee, but we hope that it also helps viewers who are less familiar with oil taxes to better understand the current system. So slide 2 is a list of acronyms. Committees have in the past asked us to spell out various acronyms, and the oil and gas industry and oil and gas taxes tend to have a lot of acronyms and jargon. So I'm going to try to minimize those as much as possible, but some are really unavoidable. So we include this slide for the record as a reference as we're going through the presentation. On slide 3 now, the purpose of the presentation again is to explain the nuts and bolts of the production tax and Alaska's fiscal system for oil and gas, basically to talk about what we have and how it works. The presentation is not intended to talk about policy, rather to make sure that there's a solid understanding of how the existing system works for North Slope oil. We will start by looking at all the sources of oil and gas revenue to the state. Then we will do a detailed walkthrough of the production tax in each step of the production tax calculation. We'll be looking at fiscal year 2022. In detail per the fall 2020 forecast. And then at the end of the presentation, we'll look at a five-year overview from fiscal year 2019 through 2023. Slide 4 is a disclaimer as we go through the presentation. The analysis is attempting to take a very complex tax system and break it down into understandable pieces. So we've put this analysis together based on aggregated data and our fall forecast estimates of various items in the tax calculation. I'm an economist and not an auditor, so anything that I say is not an official tax interpretation. It's a walkthrough of the revenue forecast to illustrate the tax calculation. Moving on to slide 5, Alaska receives state revenue from oil and gas from 4 primary sources. State royalty is received for any production from state land. We also receive a share of royalty from production on federal land. Corporate income tax is based on worldwide income apportioned to Alaska, and this applies to many but not all of the companies operating in the state. The property tax, which applies to all property anywhere in the state and within the state's 3-mile limit. And then finally, the production tax, which is our severance tax on oil and gas. This also applies to all production anywhere in the state and within the state's 3-mile limit offshore. And so with a couple of these, royalty in particular, not all oil is the same. And we do have a slide at the end of the presentation that that looks at how production from different categories of land is treated for revenue purposes. Moving on to slide 6. Slide 6 shows all the sources of state revenue from oil and gas from fiscal year 2019 through fiscal year 2023. A couple notes on this slide. The property tax is the state's share only. There's an additional amount of property tax that goes to municipalities, including the North Slope Borough. The corporate income tax here applies only to C corporations under federal tax law. There's some temporary impacts to the corporate income tax looking at fiscal years 2020 through 2022 that have to do with the federal tax law changes in the Federal CARES Act that we discussed a few weeks ago in our fall forecast presentation.
Representative Wool has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It pertains to this page or the one before, but corporate income tax, C corps, and everyone knows that BP was sold as a C corp to Hill Corp. That's an S corp. Is that the only notable S corp in the oil production world, or are there other smaller ones that aren't at the forefront like Hillcorp is?
Representative Wool, through the chair, so we can't speak to whether any specific company is a taxpayer or what their corporate status is due to taxpayer confidentiality rules. What I can say is that there are multiple companies, multiple producers in the state that are not C corporations and would be passed through entities. And those represent about 30% of total oil and gas production in the state.
Follow up.
Just so I understand your answer, because you mentioned the 30% last meeting that you were here. What you're saying is all the S corps comprise 30% of the oil production on North Slope, and you're also saying that there's more than one that's an S corp, if I'm hearing you correctly, although you can't publicly say which one's which. Some of them are common knowledge.
Representative Wool, through the chair, to clarify, the 30% represents production from companies that are not subject to the corporate income tax. So this would be various pass-through entities, would include S-corps as well as partnerships.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
So again, continuing on slide 6, the next line is production tax, which is the focus of most of this presentation. Then we have state royalties. This revenue amount includes the royalty revenue as well as related bonuses, rents, and interest. The amount here is total royalties to the state, which includes the share of royalties that go to the permit fund and the school fund. And constitutional budget reserve settlements, These are based on assessments or disputes regarding any prior year production tax royalty or other oil and gas or minerals taxes. Those funds are deposited to the budget reserve fund per the state constitution. And then the final oil and gas revenue source is shared revenue from the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, abbreviated as NPRA. 50% of any of those federal royalties and related revenues from that area are shared back to the state, but there's special provisions around how those monies can be used by the state. This is a relatively small piece at the moment, but as new developments come online in the petroleum reserve, we are expecting this to become a bigger piece of the revenue picture in future years. Slide 7 shows the overall order in which the elements of the fiscal system are applied. Royalties come first. Those are based on the ownership of the land. The owners get their share of the resource right off the top before any taxes are applied. Property taxes second. State and local property taxes are considered lease expenditures that can be applied against production tax. And so then we get to the production tax. That comes after royalties are subtracted, and it allows property tax as a deduction. Then state corporate income tax, which uses worldwide income as part of the tax base. Property tax and production tax are both excluded from that tax base. And finally, federal corporate income tax, which allows all state taxes, including the state corporate income tax, to be deducted in calculating the federal corporate income tax.
Got a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you. This is maybe a question for the chair or the presenter. But we were just talking about tax, going through the order of operations only on tax. We're not, because over, I would think we have another little section over here on royalties where we talk about the deductions that are made from our royalty share. And are we going to have any kind of overview on that piece as well?
Mr. Stickle, is that in your presentation?
Representative Johnson and Mr. Chairman, so the focus of the presentation today is primarily on the production tax. The purpose of this slide is to put production tax in context. I believe in prior years, the Department of Natural Resources has prepared kind of a similar overview of royalties. And so I would defer to them on the royalties piece on how that's calculated.
Thank you.
And Mr. Stickle?
Sure, we'll continue on to slide 8. So this moves into the production tax. This is our order of operations table. There's a lot going on this slide, so we'll spend several slides unpacking it piece by piece. This table is based on the income statement that's in Appendix E of the Revenue Sources book, and it walks through the illustration of the production tax calculation for fiscal year 2022. So we start with the forecast of average oil price of $48 per barrel. That was the fall forecast, and the forecasted daily production of 439.6 thousand barrels per day. Then we calculate the annual barrels and the dollar value of that production. So our focus for the next several slides will be on that total annual value of $7.7 billion and how that is split and taxed. And again, a few notes. This is an aggregation of the tax calculation, and it's just for North Slope oil, which is the largest portion of the production tax revenue. So walking through the income statement, we'll start at the top in slide 9. Step 1 is calculating taxable barrels. Any royalty barrels are subtracted regardless of the ownership of those barrels. Typical royalty rates are 1/8 or 12.5% or 1/6 or 16.67%. Rates do vary among the fields. Federal and private land royalty is subtracted in addition to state royalty. And this adjustment here also subtracts any production that is not subject to tax due to being in federal waters. This would be currently a small portion of North Star production. Production from a field like Liberty would also fall into this category in the future. So then we arrive at taxable barrels, and we're estimating 141 million taxable barrels for a total taxable value of $6.8 billion.
Representative Wool?
Yeah, I'm just trying to follow along. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I see in the highlighted portion your total annual production value. You deduct the royalty value, whatever that fraction thereof, and you didn't. You said that there's a couple. I don't know which one we're looking at right there, if it's eighth or a. I guess the royalty that's deducted, that's because a certain percentage of the oil that's produced doesn't belong. It belongs to the state. That's calculated in barrels, right? And then you're converting those barrels to dollars. And then you're deducting the value of that oil from the $48 per barrel price to bring it to $38. You're sort of reverse engineering the price based on the deduction in barrels that are paid in royalty. Does that make sense?
Representative Wool, through the chair. So just to reiterate here, in the calculation of taxable barrels, and again, this is just for determining the tax base for the production tax. We start with the total annual production. We're estimating 160 million barrels of total annual production. Of that, we are estimating that 19 million barrels will be royalty and related barrels. And those are not subject to production tax. And then the resulting taxable barrels is the 141 million barrels are subject to production tax. And given a estimated oil price of $48 per barrel, that gives us a value of those taxable barrels of about $6.8 billion.
Got it. I'm with you.
Okay. Please continue, Mr. Stickle.
So slide 10 then takes us to the next step, which is calculation of gross value at point of production. This is a term used widely in production tax and royalty. It's also called the wellhead value, and you'll see those terms used interchangeably. So to get to gross value at point of production, we subtract transportation costs, which are also referred to as netback costs. Another example, we have two terms that are kind of used interchangeably. So we start with that sales price at market, the $48 per barrel, and then we subtract out each piece of the transportation charge to get from the sales value to what the oil is worth at the oil field, at the wellhead value. So the $48 is at the West Coast, which would be Long Beach and Anacortes are the major destinations. And then from there, we deduct marine tanker costs, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff, any feeder pipeline tariffs, and any quality bank adjustment. And so for fiscal year 2022, just under $10 in total transportation costs gets us to an average gross value at point of production of $38.09 per barrel. And that total works out to $5.4 billion of gross value at point of production. So slide 11 starts the process of getting to the production tax value. The production tax is essentially a modified net profits tax. So companies are able to deduct capital and operating expenditures in calculating their tax base. For capital expenditures, we use IRS guidelines in general to define what is a capital expense. We do not require companies to use any depreciation for the production tax. They get an immediate deduction of all capital costs in the year incurred. operating expenditures are any allowable expenditures other than the capital expenditures. So generally, these would be ongoing costs of operations and labor. Two terms to understand here are allowable and deductible lease expenditures. Allowable lease expenditures are any cost in the unit directly associated with producing the oil. But not everything is allowable. Examples of costs that companies may incur that are not allowable in production tax include financing costs, lease acquisition costs, litigation costs, dismantlement, removal, restoration, things like that. And then the other term that we will use in our presentations is deductible lease expenditures. This is a term of art that we've developed for presentation purposes. It's not part of any statute or regulation. And what we mean when we say deductible lease expenditures is that portion of the allowable lease expenditures that are applied in the tax calculation in the year incurred up to the gross value. And so the non-deductible lease expenditures then would be any allowable expenditures beyond a company's gross value. And those turn into carry forwards that can be potentially used to offset future years' production taxes.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Stickle, on page 11, in House Bill 111 several years ago, we effectively said if you've got operating and capital expenditures and no production, you can use those expenditures, you can deduct them against future production, but it's time limited. It was 7 to 10 years or something, right? In other words, you better be confident you're going to come into production relatively soon, or you might be stuck with those costs forevermore. Is that right?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, you're correct. That's a nuance of the carry forward lease expenditures. So a company does, if a company earns those carry forward expenditures, they do begin to decrease in value beginning in the 8th or 11th year after being earned.
So one of the impacts of that reform was you better have good geologists and know what you're doing, essentially. I mean, or you're just basically that. You better have real confidence in your plan of production. Is that right?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, said the House Bill 111, what that did is it made a change from the previous way these lease expenditures that were not applicable against the tax liability, the previous way we treated those is we allowed a company to get a credit for those. And that credit could in some ways be cashed out by the state. Instead, now they earn this ability to carry forward the lease expenditures. And as you mentioned, depending on whether they have future tax liability, they may or may not be able to receive the full value of those. So it definitely impacts decision making and the economics of making those investments.
Thank you.
Got questions from Representative Ortiz and then Wohl. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Stickle. Again, on page 11, in the category of downstream transportation costs, a deductible item, does that vary very much? In other words, does that, I think it's a percentage of the per barrel value, I think. Is there any variance other than the cost of per barrel or that causes the transportation cost figure to change?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, as to the transportation cost overall changing over time, one of the there's a few important variables there. One is the overall level of production. For the Trans-Alaska pipeline in particular, if you have more production going through the pipeline, then the fixed costs of operating that pipeline are distributed over a greater number of barrels. And so you end up with lower per barrel costs if you have more production. As far as transportation costs among different fields, there is variance between different fields. And one of the impacts there is that some fields have feeder pipelines and pay tariffs for those feeder pipelines, whereas Prudhoe Bay, for example, does not have a feeder pipeline. They're able to put their production right into the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need a clarification on these columns you have on the spreadsheets. For example, deductible expenditures, those are going to the far right column because the company's going to tell you how much they spent on operating and capital, and those are your $2.257 and $2 billion on the far right. And then what you're doing is dividing by the number of barrels to give the per barrel expenditures. So you're starting with the number on the far right, and then you're sort of populating the per barrel column after you do the simple division. No one's calculating their expenditures per barrel initially, correct? I'm just, because I see these columns filling up, and I don't know which order you're filling them, but you're filling this one on the gross value far right column, correct? And then you divide by production.
Representative Wool, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to understand, and one quick follow-up to Representative Ortiz's question on transportation. It certainly is dependent on production because the more you're moving, the cheaper it is per barrel to move on an economy of scale. But after a while, if you're using the value of the pipeline as a production cost, is over time that cost get less because the pipeline's been paid for a few times over, or you're, you know, it's aside from maintenance, does it get cheaper over time to move oil through the pipeline, everything else being equal?
Representative Wool, through the chair, that's a great question, and that's not my particular area of expertise. So I don't know if our tax director wants to chime in on that point, or maybe we can provide some follow-up information on that one.
I'm going to guess, Ms. Glover, that's probably not your area of expertise either.
Good afternoon, committee. This is Colleen Glover, Tax Division Director. I can just a little bit of context. You know, for pipelines, they are regulated. Well, common carrier pipelines are regulated by both the federal entity and the state. And so there are specific provisions on what they can charge. Basically, it's a cost of service model for them to recoup cost and return on investment. So they do vary over time with the amount that they can actually get in their return. And so it is a function of their costs to run it and the volume that goes down it.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember a few years ago there was quite a conversation in committee meetings about the deductions for capital or operating. It seems like that there was a thought that worldwide companies that are testing out new drilling methods or new how to get more oil out of sands, let's try it in Alaska because we can deduct all the costs from our taxes up there and our production up there. Is that, do I mind remembering that right?
This is Dan Stickle again for the record. Representative Thompson, through the chair, we've been through several oil tax debates, and you know, there was some discussion in some of the previous oil tax debates about some of the motivations behind some of the spending that takes place. I'd prefer not to rehash that debate today if we could avoid it.
Okay, please continue with your presentation.
So, Mr. Chairman, continuing on, I believe we had finished with slide 11 and we're moving into slide 12. Slide 12 is where we get to the production tax value, which is the tax base for the production tax, also abbreviated as PTV. The production tax value is gross value at point of production less deductible lease expenditures, basically the net profit on the slope. So each company calculates its production tax value based on all of their North Slope activity, including all fields and any new developments that the company is undertaking. Again, this is essentially the tax base for the production tax. On slide 13, to throw the first of several wrinkles into it, there are two parallel calculations that are done side by side, and the final tax ends up being the higher of. So we have the production tax value that we just talked about. We also have a minimum tax calculation of a minimum tax floor, and that floor is 4% of gross value at point of production when oil prices are greater than $25 per barrel for the year. If oil prices were to be average less than $25 per barrel for a year, the minimum tax rate would decrease below 4%. But for fiscal year 2022, we're forecasting a minimum tax rate at the 4% applied to the gross value point of production of $5.4 billion. That gets us to about $215.5 million. Of a minimum tax floor.
Got a question from Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 74.5 deduction, did you say what that was? And the net tax?
Sure. Representative Wool, through the chair, we'll get to that in the next two slides.
You're just doing the other I got you.
Yeah, so what we're doing here is there's two calculations side by side. There's a minimum tax floor, and then there's a net profits tax. And we'll walk through both of those calculations. Slide 14 is some information about the gross value reduction, just to give some background as we walk into that piece of the tax calculation. This is an incentive for new development that was enacted as part of the Senate Bill 21 tax reform passed in 2013. The gross value reduction, or GVR, is a temporary benefit, and it's used to refer to oil from qualifying new fields. The GVR expires after 7 years of production, or any 3 years of which oil prices were greater than $70 per barrel. And so what the benefit is from the GVR is that a company can exclude 20 or 30% of the gross value from those qualifying fields in calculating their production tax value. What that does is it reduces the net tax calculation for those fields. The 20% is for new fields generally. The 30% applies if a field is comprised exclusively of state-issued leases with greater than 12.5% royalty. Another wrinkle related to the gross value reduction is that eligible production receives a flat $5 per barrel of taxable production credit that can be used to reduce tax below the minimum tax for any companies that do not take the sliding scale credit. and we'll get into the distinction between those per barrel credits in a few slides.
Got a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sickle, if you could quickly go back to slide 13. And maybe you just explained that with this most recent slide 14, and it might have slipped by me. But if you go to your minimum tax calculation of 215 million, point five, that's like the floor tax, 4%. But then you go to the bottom right-hand figure, and it says 163 million was actually paid. How is it that you can go below the minimum in actual taxes paid?
Sure, Representative Ortiz, through the chair, and I was planning to address this a little bit later, but I'll go ahead and hit it now as well. So the minimum tax, the minimum tax floor, we're showing it here as an aggregate calculation. In reality, each company calculates their own minimum tax. And if a company chooses not to take any sliding scale per taxable barrel credits, they may use other credits to take their tax liability below that minimum tax. So the minimum tax is a hard floor for companies that choose to take sliding scale per taxable barrel credits. If a company forgoes those credits, they may use other credits to go below the minimum tax. And in our official revenue forecast, we are assuming that at $48 per barrel oil, some companies will elect not to use sliding scale credits and instead pay below the minimum tax.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
All right, so I'll move to slide 15 now. This is the calculation of the net tax, including the gross value reduction that we just talked about. The net tax, the headline tax rate is 35% of production tax value. We show the impact of the gross value reduction here. That this is for those companies with a positive production tax value that were able to reduce it with that gross value reduction provision. The 35% tax rate applied to the production tax value after GVR yields a net tax of $367 million for fiscal year 2022. And so then we compare. Moving on to tax credits against liability, I'm on slide 16. The major credits are the per taxable barrel credits, which are actually two separate credits in statute. One is the $5 per barrel credit for gross value reduction eligible oil, and the other is a sliding scale credit for non-gross value reduction oil. The vast majority is the non-GVR credits, but that could change with major new fields coming online in the future. For those non-GVR production fields, there's a sliding scale credit. It is $8 per barrel at wellhead values of $80 and below, and gradually steps down to zero credit at wellhead values greater than $150 per barrel of taxable production. As I mentioned, the non-GVR sliding scale credits cannot be used to reduce the tax below the minimum tax. And any companies claiming that credit cannot use other credits to pay below the minimum tax. For the GVR eligible production, again, that credit can be used to reduce tax below the minimum tax if companies do not take any sliding scale credits. These per taxable barrel credits are use it or lose it. They cannot be carried forward or refunded. So in fiscal year 2022, we're estimating that $186 million worth of per taxable barrel credits will be deducted in calculating the tax liability, even though $1.1 billion worth of per taxable barrel credits would be generated. Again, they can only use those credits to get down to the minimum tax for the sliding scale, and then in some instances to go below for the non-sliding scale credits. And then we have other tax credits against liability. These include small producer credits, state in any given year. This is just kind of a reconciliation of our simple calculation with the official revenue forecast for fiscal year 2022. This adjustments number includes any prior year tax payments or refunds. It includes the state has a tax on private landowner royalty interest, a hazardous release surcharge. This is the so-called nickel per barrel tax. Any taxes on gas on the North Slope, and any net tax liability from Cook Inlet oil and gas, and any additional company-specific details in the tax calculation. So for fiscal year 2022, the $163.3 million represents the fall forecast of total cash into the general fund from the production tax. And we're also estimating that an additional $563 million of non-deductible lease expenditures are expected to be carried forward and would potentially be available to apply against future year tax liabilities. And then this is where I was going to speak to the question that Representative Ortiz asked earlier, and I'll go ahead and repeat this again here. Some folks would look at the $163.3 million of total production tax and ask, why is that lower than the minimum tax of $215.5 million? And again, that's because the minimum tax is applied on a company-by-company basis. Companies cannot go below the minimum tax if they use any sliding scale per taxable barrel credits. But we are forecasting that at $48 per barrel oil price, some companies would choose to forego the sliding scale credits and use other credits to reduce their payments below the minimum tax. And therefore, the net tax collections, when you add all of the companies together, the net tax collections are below the aggregate minimum tax calculation in our forecast.
Got a question from Representative Levon and then Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And speaking of other credits against liability, do you have an example or two of what those other credits might be?
Sure. Representative Levon, through the chair. So example of other credits against liability, one would be the small producer credit. This is a credit of up to $12 million per company. That was that credit. A sunset was put on that several years back, but some companies still have eligibility for that credit. Another example would be net operating loss credits that were earned prior to 2018 that companies still have on the books.
Thank you.
Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Stickle, it looks like gross value at point of production after you take away royalties and transportation is $5.38 billion, and the total paid to the state is $163 million. I can see why people are scratching their heads at that portion. Now, can I conclude that the royalty of $912 million, that goes to the state in its entirety? That would bring the state take up to close to $1 billion. Is that correct?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, the majority of that royalty goes to the state. Referring back to slide 6 for fiscal year 2022, we're estimating that the state royalty is $797 million. Plus an additional $12 million of shared royalty from the National Petroleum Reserve. So that would be the state royalty amount. The $912.9 million includes those state royalties. It also includes the value of federal royalties that are retained by the federal government. It includes the value of private landowner royalties. And then that adjustment also includes any production in federal waters beyond the state's 3-mile limit, which practically speaking would be a small share of production from the North Star field.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So 5.3 billion, the state gets 163 million plus royalties. And then it says new net lease expenditures earned and carried forward is 562 million, which I'm assuming is on your chart somewhere if you add a few numbers, or I don't know where you're pulling those numbers out from your chart. And also, are there carry forwards from the year before that would be applied towards this 163, or have you already done that?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, there would potentially be carry forwards that were earned in prior years. We are not estimating that any prior year carry forwards would be applied in fiscal year 2022. And where those prior year carry forwards would be applied is back at the lease expenditures stage. And so the idea is that 562 million becomes a potential addition to lease expenditures in a future tax year.
Okay, thank you.
Representative LeBon and then Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under this example, on the top of page 17, royalty and federal barrels number totals about 913 million. Of that amount, there's a portion that is deposited into the Alaska Permanent Fund. And I know it depends on the field and which formula, but is there a rough estimate based upon that number, how much of that would flow to the Alaska Permanent Fund, or am I understanding this chart correctly?
Representative LeBon, through the chair, you're correct that a portion of the state royalty does flow to the Alaska Permanent Fund. That portion is it's between 25% and 50%, depending on when the lease was issued. The average permanent fund share is about 30% of state royalties. And I am looking at page 38 of our fall revenue sources book. And we are forecasting that in fiscal year 2022, $199.2 million of oil and gas royalties and related revenue go to the permanent fund.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Stickle, where you say at the bottom of page 17, net new lease expenditures, those would, in a future year, appear, as you said, under North Slope lease expenditures. Is that right?
That's correct. Follow-up? Potentially.
And so if those were appearing in FY22, would the total tax paid be less than $163 million? Or is it hard to know because coming with those expenditures would be new production and therefore new revenue to the state? Does that make sense?
Yeah, Representative Josephson, through the chair. So the lease expenditures would be carry forward lease expenditures may be elected at a company's option. And so generally, you would expect that a company would apply those carried forward lease expenditures only if they would expect to be paying above the minimum tax in a future year. So they would have to have sufficient future year revenue to be able to benefit from those lease expenditures. Also, as far as the question of production goes, there is a provision that in order to use a carry forward lease expenditure, you do have to have production from the field where that lease expenditure was earned.
Follow up?
Well, I
It's just interesting that, well, yeah, follow. Mr. Stickle, my memory of this is that when people 10 years ago were standing around the proverbial water cooler talking about state revenue, they didn't talk about royalty. They talked about tax. Royalty was an afterthought. Is that, that's sort of true, isn't it? Because we were bringing in $6-8 billion, maybe eight's high, but $6 or $7 billion in our peak years a decade ago. Now we're looking at $163 million. Do I have that roughly correct?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I guess there was a question. It is true that production tax represented a significantly larger share of the state's oil and gas revenue in prior years. Production tax generated $6.1 billion in fiscal year 2012 out of a little under $10 billion of total oil revenue that year.
And just a last follow-up.
Representative Josephson?
I think this is well known, but the factors, the part that is, that no one disputes is that the price is lower. The part that is disputed is whether the economy at large, in the form of jobs in the private sector, benefits from SB 21, and whether we're encouraging more production that wouldn't be there versus the change in tax. But I understand you don't want to revisit that. That's fine. Thank you.
I had a question, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you have this data available, but the transportation costs, which I guess changes over time based on what a tanker charges. I feel like the pipeline's fairly fixed, more or less. So when production was, say, 1 million barrels a day, and I don't know when that was, you referred back to 2012 as a $10 billion year, so maybe that had a high production. I don't know what the price was in 2012, but let's say it's a high production year. What did that do to the transportation? If there's twice as much oil going through, was the transportation? And I guess there's
sure involved too. But yeah, Representative Wolt through the chair. So the million barrels a day production, I think we'd have to go back to the early 2000s. I have a 10-year history in front of me. I'm looking at page 105 of the Revenue Sources book. Looking back at 2011, for example, the total transportation charge was $6.67 per barrel. So it was somewhat lower.
What was the price
at that point?
What was the price in production then?
That was a year where price averaged $94.49 per barrel. Production that year was about 600,000 barrels per day for the North Slope. So generally, when you're looking at transportation costs, there's a few factors that impact the direction of costs over time. For some elements like the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the total production level is a very important factor. There are some other elements that move with price and general inflation. Tanker costs are an example where one of the important factors influencing tanker costs is the price of the fuel to move those tankers. But looking over a longer time history, and we'd be happy to provide that to the committee as a follow-up. I think if you go back further in time, the general trend that you see is that the cost of transportation on a per barrel basis has grown over time as production has decreased. And then we've actually seen a stabilization of the transportation cost over the last several years, which has been kind of concurrent with a stabilization of production on the North Slope.
Representative Wool?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess price of fuel certainly would affect the tanker cost. At $94 a barrel oil, you'd expect the tanker fuel cost to be higher. $600,000 is higher than our current $500,000 by 20%. I guess the cost of transport is sort of interesting. On a $48 barrel, $10 goes to transportation, and it certainly isn't lost that the people that own the oil, own the pipeline, that probably own the tankers too. So it's not a bad thing if they can get a good transport fee for their oil. So. I'd like to look into it further. Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that back when we had a pipeline that had a lot more oil going through it, the oil friction would heat up while it was going down through the line. Now that we are 500,000 or less barrels a day, I know that that oil comes through cold, and when it's extremely cold, they are now heating that oil to keep it flowing down through that line. Do they figure in a fixed cost per year, and that's part of what they use, and that heating that oil is an increase in that transportation cost?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, the short answer to the question is yes. So my understanding is that the Trans-Alaska Pipeline has added additional heating capacity, and those costs end up, they work their way through the tariff calculation, and they do eventually get passed on to the shippers of the oil.
Representative Lebon in the Northeast.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you look at the price of oil and where it has fallen since 2014, if you, aside from employment on the North Slope and the throughput of the pipeline as far as the volume of oil, is the state better off with SB 21 with production tax revenue versus ACEs if you just consider the lower average price of our oil over the last half dozen years?
Representative Lebon, through the chair, that's the million-dollar question. I'm not really prepared to opine on the answer to that question. My goal here today is to walk through the current tax calculation so that folks have a solid understanding of how it works.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was just brought up, so I was just wondering if he had some insight as to if the state benefited from Senate Bill 21 versus ACES at a lower price, average lower price of oil over the last half dozen years. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, I'm certainly no tax accountant. You know, I struggle through TurboTax, and I say, okay, I pay that amount of money when I get to the bottom line there, and that's the way I do it. But in the world of taxes, I know there's something called an effective tax rate. Is it safe to say, based on how Alaska, under Alaska's oil tax system, the effective tax rate, in essence, is different for each company? What they're paying is different based on the different factors that that company operates and the way the company operates in the state of Alaska?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, that's correct. So each company is going to have a separate tax calculation. It's going to be based on the different fields and developments that those companies are involved in, and the effective tax rate is going to vary.
Paul?
And would you say that are you prepared to opine as to the range of the effective tax rate that's being paid out there by oil industry in the state of Alaska?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I know we have that analysis. I don't have it in front of me right now. I think I'd prefer to go ahead and include that as a follow-up.
Thank you.
Please continue, Mr. Stickle.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So I believe I had talked through slide 17 and was ready to move on to slide 18, which is a five-year overview, looking at 2 years of historical data, the current year, and then 2 years of forecast data. So we forecast that production tax value went from $5.1 billion in fiscal year 19 and has declined each year since. And in the forecast, we're forecasting $1.1 billion of production tax value for fiscal year 22 and less than $1 billion of production tax value for fiscal year 23. So fiscal years 21, 22, and 23 under the fall forecast, those are forecasted as minimum tax years, which means generally companies are able to use credits to bring production tax down to that minimum tax. And then at the forecasted oil prices, we estimate that some companies will choose to forego the sliding scale credits and use other credits to pay below the minimum tax. So you do see that phenomenon in all three of those years where the estimated production tax to the state is below the calculated minimum tax floor.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Stickle, in the, I don't know if it was House Bill 247 or 111, we hardened the floor other than this GVR option. There's nothing that prohibits us from hardening the floor further, right? In theory, there's no contract doctrine or common law doctrine that would theoretically stop us from saying when we say 4%, we mean 4%. Is that true?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, that's correct.
And please continue.
So that concluded the main body of the presentation. We have a few additional slides that we had added at the request of the other body and went ahead and included them here as well for your benefit. Slide 19 is a slide that shows how revenue would be impacted by different levels of the sliding scale per taxable barrel credit. Currently, that is sliding scale credit goes up to $8 per taxable barrel. And this table shows what the fiscal year 2022 tax calculation would look like, assuming a maximum value of $5, $4, or $3 per taxable barrel. So not all of the per taxable barrel credit gets used due to the tax floor. And in some cases, companies can use other credits to make up for a reduction in the per barrel credits. So the impact on production taxes from a credit change of $1 is less than $1 times the number of barrels. But going from $8 to $5 as the maximum per taxable barrel sliding scale credit would increase estimated production tax revenue from $163 million to $180 million for fiscal year 2022. That number would be $207 million with a $4 maximum credit and $234 million with a $3 maximum credit. We're not making a policy suggestion here. Obviously, any changes in the credit would have impacts on investment and economics. We're just showing the scenarios that were requested last year in the other body. And then slide 20 is a new slide that we added this year. This looks at what the tax calculation would look like if there were a single taxpayer for the entire North Slope. And this kind of gets at the line of questioning from Representative Ortiz a little bit earlier. So currently, as we discussed, some companies pay at or above the minimum tax, while others choose to forego the sliding scale credits and reduce payments below the minimum tax. And so what happens is our fiscal year 2022 production tax forecast is less than the aggregate minimum tax calculation. But on slide 20, if there were only one taxpayer, we would expect that they would use sliding scale credits to reduce their tax liability down to the minimum tax, but then they would not be allowed to go below the minimum tax. And so in this illustration, the total production tax to the Treasury would be $229 million in fiscal 22, compared to the $163 million in the official forecast. And what this highlights is the impact of individual company economics on the tax. As we discussed, each company has a different portfolio of operations and investments. And finally, slide 21 is a slide that shows how state petroleum revenues vary by land type. The basic concept is that not all oil is the same. So production tax, corporate tax, and property tax apply everywhere in the state except for federal waters beyond 3 miles offshore, regardless of the ownership of the land. Royalty, on the other hand, varies depending on the ownership of the land. So there's different royalty provisions depending on if you're on state land, private land, different categories of federal land. So we include this as kind of a reference resource when you're looking at production from different land types.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the presentation. There was a question yesterday about oil prices that I'd like to address, if this is a good time for that.
Yes, go ahead.
Sure. So the question yesterday had to do with oil prices and why Alaska's oil prices diverged from Brent oil prices last year. So Alaska North Slope oil is not a widely traded crude, and for that reason, we like to compare its price to a global Brent benchmark. We use Brent crude as the closest comparison. It's a crude of similar quality, and both crudes are waterborne, meaning they have ready access to the world markets by tanker. Typically, Alaska North Slope and Brent crude are priced very similar in the market with only slight differences in value, and you'll see ANS may trade for a dollar or two higher or lower than Brent at any given point in time. And so at the end of March of last year, ANS and Brent were near parity, which is a typical relationship. But then beginning in April, the estimated value of ANS dropped below Brent, and the discount got as large as $28.25 per barrel on April 20th. That was the day that ANS prices were estimated at a negative value, the lowest price on record, while Brent prices remained over $25. And then that divergence lasted through April and then the first part of May. And by May 20th, ANS prices were back to trading in tandem with Brent. And that's been largely the case since. And so that was just a little bit of background on what happened last year. As to the question of why there was that divergence, there was a lot of turmoil in the oil market last spring. We saw an unprecedented demand drop as COVID situation was starting to unfold and rapidly filling oil storage. There was tremendous uncertainty in the oil markets. Looking at the ANS Brent divergence, we believe that reflected West Coast and Pacific specific market dynamics. The West Coast and Pacific saw some of the largest drops in demand, and at the same time, storage in these markets was filling up very rapidly in the spring. At one point, there were literally dozens of oil tankers parked offshore California looking for a place to put their oil. And so for a period of time, anyone trying to sell ANS into the market was selling into an extremely oversaturated market. Eventually, the markets worked through that supply-demand, and we saw ANS prices return to their historical relationship with Brent in fairly short order. Unfortunately, part of that supply-demand balance involved the temporary curtailments in Alaska production. That's one example of how those markets came back into balance.
Got a question for Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And speaking about shipping oil out of Alaska, most of it goes to the U.S. West Coast. What percentage actually goes east instead of down south to the West Coast? And what are the factors that vary where the oil is shipped to West Coast refineries or international markets?
Representative Lebon, through the chair. So historically, most ANS oil has gone to the West Coast of the United States. That is still the case. There are some examples of oil being shipped overseas to the Far East, being Asia markets. We've talked to several industry experts about that phenomenon, and there's a couple of potential things going on. One is the changing mix of oil and gas producers in the state, where we're moving from a situation where the companies were largely fully integrated, where they owned the oil field and the production all the way down to the refinery and the distribution. Some companies are moving away from that model where they're just a producer and then they're selling into the market. Another impact that's been cited is just taking advantage of pricing trends in U.S. versus Asia, and that, you know, if a company is selling into a market and they don't necessarily own the refinery, they'll look to where they can get the best price, and sometimes that price is on the West Coast, sometimes it's in Asia.
A follow-up to that, Alaska doesn't have any say into where that oil heads, whether it's West Coast refinery or a Far East international market. And is Alaska disadvantaged if the oil, say, heads to an international destination versus the West Coast?
Representative Lebon, through the chair, so the one place that we do have a say is in state royalty oil, and I know some of that is taken by Department of Natural Resources and sold to the in-state refineries. As far as from a tax perspective, you know, we assume that a company would act in its best interest and go out and get the best possible value for that oil. And so, you know, from that perspective, the state would benefit by the company getting the best possible value for its oil.
Thank you. Okay. I don't want any further questions. Representative Wool and then Ortiz.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Stickle, for this presentation. It's certainly nice to see it all laid out like that. I may not retain all those details that you gave us, but I got a pretty good takeaway. And I guess Representative Josephson made a comment earlier, which was having to do with incentives and tax credits. And to look at that and all the credits and to look at the production curve of the production slope, it doesn't seem to be going in the right direction, incentives are not. So I think that's concerning. And when you look at the bottom line of $163 million with, you know, $5.8 billion after royalties, it seems like a pittance. And, you know, I guess the price is low, but I think that to me is the driver of a lot of this production stuff. But I'm interested in the transportation, and at another time maybe I can
try to go deeper on that with pipeline costs and tanker costs and, you know, how that's determined. And, again, seeing as a lot of it's owned by the same corporations, maybe there isn't much incentive to lower that price. But for us in Alaska, I think there is an incentive. So, anyhow, thank you for your presentation.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, I'll add my thanks for your presentation. It was a good presentation. Appreciate it very much. Correct me if I'm wrong. Have your duties in the past to the state, both maybe in, have they always been in relationship to Department of Revenue, or do they include years with DNR?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair. So I've been with Revenue for my entire state career. I started in 2004. I worked as a non-petroleum economist and then a petroleum economist and then moved into a management role about a decade ago.
And did those duties include, or do they include today, being a part of production forecasting?
Representative Ortiz, to the chair, I am involved in the process. We work collaboratively with DNR on the production forecast, but they are the lead on that project.
And so, based on that, I had a question back when the commissioner of DNR was making the presentation involving production forecasts. And those production forecasts look like for the next 10 years or so to stay, likely to stay right around 500,000 barrels a day. And I referenced that when we went back, when you go back to the years of about 2012, 2013, at that point when they were debating and eventually adopting Senate Bill 21, they were talking about getting back up to a million barrels a day. And so my question for you is, if you care to opine on that, what has changed in either the world situation or Alaska situation that have caused us to move so much drastically down from where they thought we would be based on production 10 years ago to now saying, well, for the next 10 years, we'll be likely staying around 500,000 barrels a day. Why has that changed?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair. So that is a topic that could warrant its own presentation. A couple observations I would make is that the million barrels per day goal that was set, I believe, was aspirational in nature. Some of the things that have changed over the last decade are that oil prices have fallen quite a bit from where they were back in 2013. There are some potential areas of new production, such as the Outer Continental Shelf, that have not come to fruition. But again, there's many different factors in play as to why we have not got to that aspirational goal at this point.
And not likely to get there in the near future anyway.
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, as you mentioned, the production forecast anticipates fairly stable production over the coming decade.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I remember right, about 8 years ago, we were losing about 6% throughput per year, and it was going down and down. And when SB 21 passed, they were making projections without SB 21 that we would be down in the 300,000 barrels per day, possibly going through the line. And they were talking about if it gets down that low, we'd probably have to shut the line down. And then we passed SB 21, and we did get it back up, and we're not losing 6% a year. So am I remembering that right?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, again, you know, my goal is not to rehash any past oil tax debates today, but Yes, it there is a correlation there. Oil production has roughly stabilized over the past 8 years or so.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stickle, I forgot to ask you this earlier, and again, I'm kind of hung up on this transport cost, but when oil dropped, I know it went to the negative for a while, and that's when there was a glut and we had to throttle down the pipeline. And I had this sort of epiphany that if the pipeline were to stop functioning, it wouldn't be for mechanical or physical reasons, it would be fiscal. If the price at $10 a barrel for transport, what if oil's at $18 for a prolonged period? Suddenly, is there any money left over? And if the companies are losing money pushing it through, at some point they're just going to turn it off, regardless of the mechanical capabilities of the pipeline. So what happens if $10 is fairly fixed and the oil goes down to $24 for an extended period, which historically $24 in the early days of the pipeline was probably a pretty good number. But now what would happen if the transport cost was such a large percentage of the per barrel cost? Are we going to run into that problem if oil, for some reason, is a glut or people start driving their electric cars and so on and so forth? Is that a risk?
Yeah, Representative Wall, through the chair, it is a risk. So transportation costs come off the top before a company gets to deduct any costs of production. And when you look at the pie that's left over, the greater the transportation cost, the less the pie that is left over. And you did see, I think you got a glimpse of what might happen if you had a prolonged period of low oil prices earlier this spring, where one of the major companies chose to curtail their production as a result of the low price environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Stickle, if using the numbers and data that you have, if you put the price in instead of 48, if you put it in at 28, is there a point? Do you have that number? Everything else being equal, production being equal, do you have that number where it doesn't pan out for certainly not for the state? I can see that number going to zero pretty quick. But oil companies, I guess they can massage the numbers so they can still make money. But do you know what that number is, where it's sort of break even-ish?
Sure, Representative Wolf, through the chair. So the break even price is going to vary for each company. In the aggregate, we estimate that break even price is somewhere between $40 and $50 per barrel. So we are, for the fall forecast, we are just above that point.
Last one, I promise. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Final comment, Representative Wolf.
Thank you. So that being said, between 40 and 50, which is where we are right now, if there's some geopolitical event or otherwise, as like General Motors has mentioned, they're going to go all electric cars in a certain period, and if there's a glut or low demand, we could be at a sub 40 price for a prolonged period in the very near future. And I guess we should base some of our fiscal decisions with that in mind. Is that, do you guys think about that, or you just figure we'll figure it out?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, there's always a risk on oil prices. And when we prepare our oil price forecast, there's a table in the revenue sources book that presents a low and a high case. And yeah, I think it's good advice to look at that low case and ponder what we would do in that situation. We've been very fortunate that oil prices have increased, and you know, they've been up around the $60 per barrel range recently, but there's no guarantee that they'll stay there.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any other comments or questions? Okay, well, I see none. And so with that, thank you very much, Mr. Stickle, as well as Ms. Glover and Mr. Barnhill, for being here. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, March 4th at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we'll hear a presentation from the Department of Education on the K-12 formula, student enrollment counts, and COVID relief funding. So if there's nothing to come for the committee, we will be adjourned at 3 o'clock p.m. Thank you.